Good afternoon. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on House website. As is customary with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Chair Eklund, present. Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, present. Representative Detmer.
Present.
Representative Detmer, present. Representative McDonald.
McDonald here.
Representative McDonald, present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg, present. Representative Bliss. Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick. Representative Greenman.
Here, present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Here, present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Poston, present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Petrie. Members, I want to take this opportunity today to acknowledge that today is the National Vietnam War Veterans Day. 49 years ago today, the final United States combat troops left South Vietnam, ending our country's direct military involvement in the Vietnam War. As the chair of the committee charged with veterans issues in the Minnesota House of Representatives, I would like to honor the sacrifices of our Vietnam War veterans and their loved ones by observing a moment of silence. Thank you. Members, we have three bills on the agenda today. The first bill is from Representative Keeler, House File 4311. I move to lay House File 4311 over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Welcome, Representative Keeler. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Also, thank you for taking that moment. I am a daughter of a Vietnam War vet who my dad actually passed away due to outcomes of Agent Orange. And so thank you for taking that moment. So House File 4311 is something that is really close to me. I like to carry bills that have human impact. And so I want to start by just sharing a story similar to what I just said about my dad. Caring for our veterans is something that is something I've been doing my whole entire life, because I come from, now we're working on the sixth generation of military service members. My family was serving in the military before we were even eligible to be considered U.S. citizens on our own land. So veterans are extremely important to me, and I want to say in this space, thank you for anybody here who has provided service to this country, but also for family members that are a part of that. So what I want to talk about is my dad's story. My dad was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and the two services he used were the VA and the IHS. The closest VA was 2.5 hours away, and so he had to drive to receive his chemotherapy, and then because there was no place for him to stay in Sioux Falls, he was driving home after chemo and having to pull over fairly regularly just to rest. I don't know if any of you have ever gone through chemo or have had loved ones go through chemo. It's really hard on your body. It was hard as a daughter to watch my dad go through that, and so what this bill does is it helps create the Fisher House in Fargo. My dad could have used a Fisher House. What this does is it allows veterans, when they're going through medical incidences or need medical supports, is that it provides, a doctor note can provide a place for us to stay. My dad could have stayed an extra night to get the rest that he needed to be able to make the 2.5 hour drive home. Yes, the Fisher House is in Fargo, North Dakota, and I want to give some data on why it's important that we invest in this. As a Greater Minnesota member, as a Border City, Minnesota member, this happens a lot. And so I know that we're giving money to North Dakota, but what I want to tell you who they serve. So out of all the veterans that the North Dakota VA serves, 12,668 of them are from Minnesota, which makes up 33% of the veterans served are from Minnesota. So I want you to keep that in mind. Also, what this bill is doing is it's a $500,000 ask to establish the land to be able to build this house. So the ask overall is an $8 million effort. They're only asking for $500,000, which is only 6% of the ask. So for a group that supports 33% of our population, only coming with a 6% ask, I think is reasonable. I also want to highlight the distance here. This is not just a Moorhead-Fargo thing. Out of the top six counties that utilize the VA in Fargo, many of them are Ottertail County, Beltrami, Becker, Polk. They're all driving anywhere from an hour to 2 hours just for these services, similar to what my dad did. So I hope that you all find it really important to not only invest in the VA and what they're doing, but to provide these extra supports as people are getting the medical care they need before they maybe have to travel back to their home communities. I'm just helping to invest in, one, what I feel is the biggest thank you to our service members, to tell them we care about you when the work that you've done to protect us is impacting your health. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll send it over to testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I understand Representative Detmer has an A1 amendment. Representative Detmer, yes, please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, I move the A1 amendment. And what I would like to, the bill appropriates, as the author spoke up here, the bill appropriates $500,000 to the general fund directly to the Fisher House. Now, I've carried a lot of different pieces of legislation in the past, and we've usually gotten, whether it's general fund money or legacy funds for veterans organizations, we always funneled that money through the MDDA or the Department of Administration. And the A1 amendment directs the appropriation to the Department of Veterans Affairs for a grant to the Fisher House Foundation. And it's important when the legislation is appropriate money, the general fund, that the agency has some oversight over those funds. And so that's my big concern. I'm supportive of the bill, but I think the MDVA should have some oversight over the funds. And in addition, I understand the MDVA will have some other concerns about the language. And I also see that Mr. Ben Johnson is here to address those concerns. So I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Ben Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Johnson. Please identify yourself for the record and provide your context.
Chair Eklund, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I have a lot of gratitude for Representative Keeler and Representative Detmer working so hard on this, as well as yourself, Chair Eklund. Yes, with regards to the A1 amendment, we've been working with the Department of Administration, as well as our friends over at the Department of Natural Resources, who have some experience working on appropriations in support of projects that are on the border. The primary concern in this case is that a grant from MDVA to the Fisher House Foundation for construction requires a lot of oversight in construction in a neighboring state. So we do have some concerns there. We would like to, we'd be happy to work with the state of North Dakota and the VA in the process of developing, in essence, a joint powers agreement as opposed to a grant. MDVA doesn't really have the capacity to be doing grant oversight for construction, but a joint powers agreement with North Dakota and or the VA would allow us to make sure that this money is used for the proper purposes. We would support the effort to have that oversight, but would appreciate if we could eliminate at least some components of the A1, give us the proper flexibility and oversight for this general fund appropriation.
Representative
Detmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also Mr. Johnson. Since additional work needs to be done on the language and on the bill, I would like to just withdraw my amendment at this time and let the author and the department work on language that would be appropriate so that things can run smoothly, especially when we cross the lines on the borders. So we need to make sure things are good and tight. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. I appreciate you withdrawing the amendment. I, as all bills that are being laid over, they are a work in progress, and I trust that we'll be able to work out the proper language between Representative Keeler and DBA to get this done. Back to the bill. Representative Keeler, do you have any further comments before you testify?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I appreciate you bringing this to me. You know, as a border city representative, I feel like this is something I need to practice more and being mindful in. And so you absolutely have my word that we're going to work on that, because I agree with you. Funneling it directly to an out-of-state organization is maybe not the best practice. So we will be working on that. Ben and I have been trying to connect in our busy schedules. And you're more than happy to join us in that effort. Yeah, to just make sure that we're doing it right.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Keeler. Just keep me posted. I'd love to sit in on anything that is worked out with the department. And my years as a veteran, and also my twin sons who are currently serving, we need to make sure, even though we're working with other states on issues, a veteran is a veteran no matter where you are. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Mr. Johnson, you're listed as a testifier. Do you have any more comments on the bill?
Chair Eklund, members, thank you. Nothing substantive except to note that this is included in the governor's supplemental budget bill as well. This is something that is important to the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And I have a lot of gratitude for Representative Keeler being so patient with me as we try to collect the information that she has patiently asked for. This is an important bill, and we want to get it right. So I'll leave it at that, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Before I turn it back to Representative Keeler, I appreciate, Representative Keeler, your opening comments, because I, too, had a veteran friend that I was transporting over to Fargo. This is several years ago. And I know that with what he is being treated for, there is absolutely no way that he could have driven himself. And so this facility is going to be greatly needed. Representative Keeler, final, or any member questions on the bill? I apologize. Any other member questions on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Keeler, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to share the story about my dad and being able to bring that into this work, because I think that's really important for us to do. I appreciate any support that you all have in this and continue to hopefully show up back in the spaces to have more meaningful conversations. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I renew my motion that House File 4311 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Next up, we have House File 3953 from Representative Berg. Representative Berg, please move and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move my bill, which is a pretty great bill. It is simple. It appropriates $300,000 in fiscal year 2023 from the general fund for a grant to Building Strong Communities for a statewide apprenticeship readiness program that focuses on preparing women, members of the BIPOC community, and veterans for the building and construction trades. Building Strong Communities is a multi-trade apprenticeship readiness program that has been intentionally designed to connect women BIPOC community members and veterans with union building and construction trade careers. The BSC program provides individuals with an opportunity to start a career in the union trades with the knowledge and skills needed to successfully enter a union registered apprenticeship program. BSC is guided by the construction industry and is focused on the long-term goal of creating career opportunities for program participants. BSA works in partnership with the industry, post-secondary institution, community organizations, project owners, and users, and municipalities. BSC works with participants through not only the program, but also through placement into their chosen trade and throughout the first year in the industry. BSC is a statewide program with programs running in the Twin Cities, Rochester, and Duluth. North Hennepin Community College administers 8 weeks of the mostly virtual classroom training, and the trades provide up to 4 weeks hands-on training to get participants ready for their trade. Participants will earn 4 college credits while attending the apprenticeship readiness program. And I believe I have a couple of testifiers, as well as when you received your packets for today's hearing, there were a couple of letters from the program graduates.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Before we get to the testifiers, I think we need to make sure that the motion is to lay the bill over. I'm not sure if you said that, so that's what Representative Berg's motion is. First testifier is Megan Hennen, Director of Government and Public Affairs Associate Builder and Contractors of Minnesota, North Dakota. Ms. Hennen, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Megan Hennen with the Associated Builders and Contractors. Our contractor members and the women and men they employ are part of the 73% of construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. They build our schools, medical facilities, restaurant retail establishments, multifamily housing, clean energy projects like solar and wind farms, and more. Our contractors have registered apprenticeship programs through the Department of Labor and Industry, some through the Federal Department of Labor, and others have customized and unique training programs tailored around their particular line of work. ABC and our contractors do not receive a dollar of state taxpayer dollars for recruiting efforts or training programs. We do not object to promoting careers in construction. ABC and our members are doing that every day, but what we object to is the lack of access groups like ABC and our contractors have to the program this bill addresses. We have not been contacted by BSC to be a partner with their group, nor are our state-approved registered apprenticeship programs listed as a resource in any of their outreach efforts or materials. When you go to their website, their mission reads, aligning stakeholders to provide industry-driven apprenticeship readiness pathways into union construction careers. This seems to be a very narrow scope. Considering the majority of Minnesota's construction workforce choose to work for merit shop contractors, it is troubling that the state is considering directing more taxpayer dollars on top of the millions of dollars in previous years that go towards excluding other leading construction industry partners in such a way. Additionally, nowhere in this funding request is there a reporting requirement for BSC to show how many women, BIPOC community members, and veterans were contacted, how many signed up for their programs, or how many obtained jobs. I also think it'd be helpful for this committee and the legislature to know where this money is going. Is it for a website, full-time employees, training? In its attempt to be inclusionary, the bill is both exclusionary and limiting, and it does not paint the full picture. In the bill's previous committee stop, it was said that anyone and everyone can join a union. That is true. But what is also true is that 73% of Minnesota's construction workforce actively choose not to. I would request that the committee take a look at this grant and ask that BSC provide all construction career paths a chance to be promoted on their marketing materials. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. Next up, Tom Dicklich, Executive Director, Minnesota State Building Construction Trades Council. Mr. Dicklich, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Dicklich. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 3953, which appropriates $300,000 in fiscal year 23 for a grant from the Commissioner of Deed to Building Strong Communities. As mentioned, Building Strong Communities is a multi-trade apprenticeship readiness program that's been intentionally designed to connect women, BIPOC community members, and veterans into registered union apprenticeship programs of their choosing. The Building Strong Communities program has been successful in transitioning some of the most underrepresented community members and getting them into meaningful family-supporting construction careers that they can feel proud of. A few years back, this started as a metro-based program that had been smaller scale but still had the goal of placing women, BIPOC community members, and veterans into the trades. This past year, we turned it into a statewide program that is in week 6 of a 12, and it continues to progress with 41 participants with 80% meeting those criteria. Once successfully completing this program, they'll be ready to enter into one of our affiliates' apprenticeship programs as the summer construction season starts up in May and June. The uniqueness of this program is that it brings together industry, post-secondary schooling, community-based organizations, project owners, and end users. The end result of this program is getting highly skilled workers into the workforce, which is our goal. Our joint apprenticeship training centers offer the best path forward to address bringing new workers into the industry, along with a path to focus on bringing women, BIPOC community members, and veterans into the trades as well. We have a proven track record of training and placing apprentices into the construction career. Approximately 93% of all active construction apprenticeships are enrolled in these joint programs. Non-JAC programs train a tiny percentage of construction workers each year. Example, the ABC apprenticeship program, Construction Education Foundation of Minnesota, has just 1% revenue and 0.4% of the total assets that the top 10 largest labor management programs have. Put it another way, we invest nearly 100 times more into worker training every year than the ABC of Minnesota and North Dakota does. We need to be diligent in how we invest our taxpayer money. We should be investing in programs with proven track records and programs that have the capacity to meet our workforce needs. Sometimes opportunity and education can be the great equalizer to allow for someone to build their lives with good blue-collar jobs so they can provide for themselves and their families. Thanks, and I'd be willing to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dicklich. Next up, I'm not going to get the first name right, so Mr. Salazar, graduate building strong communities. Mr. Salazar, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure she's on yet.
Ms. Salazar.
I believe. I do think she was working her regular day, so if we were later in the day, she'd be able to testify, but, you know, she's got to finish her work day.
Mr. Chair, actually, she is on. So,
thank you.
Ms. Salazar, please.
I do apologize. Proceed. Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and committee members. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rocio Salazar. I live in the city of Bloomington. I am proud to be a member of LUNA, Local 563, located in Minneapolis, and I am a graduate of Building Strong Communities program. I am here to speak in support of House File 3953 so that many more people can benefit from the Building Strong Communities program as I have. I decided to join the program last year, 2021, because I was in a place in my life where I wanted to find a job that it wasn't just a regular job. I wanted to make it a career. And I wanted to find a job that would help me provide for my family. My parents are getting older and soon I will have to financially support them. Building Strong Communities has really helped me. They provided me with the proper tools and boots needed to start work when I wasn't financially stable. They also helped me pay my union initiation fees in order to be able to become a laborer. Honestly, without their help, I wouldn't actually be able to join the union. So that's something that I'm very grateful for. Being a union laborer has kept my family on our feet and many more opportunities have opened up. I do see myself soon in the future being able to afford buying my own house. I wish I would have known about Building Strong Communities and the opportunities that they offer much earlier, because I would have been much further along in my career and building my pension. This program has helped me get my foot in the door when it comes to the construction and the trades. And I wanted to be able and be open and available for any other person of color, any other woman and veterans out there that want that opportunity like I did. My ongoing training combined with the union card and living wages is my ticket to the middle class and my ticket to continue to accomplish many of my goals. With millions and millions of federal and state dollars being invested in our infrastructure, we need to get the recruitment and training pipeline set up correctly for the get-go. Chair Eklund and committee members, I urge you to see the Building Strong Communities program as a tool to transform Minnesota's construction workforce to truly look like and benefit all communities across our vibrant and diverse state. I ask you all to support House File 3953 so more Minnesotans like me can begin lifelong careers when it comes to building construction.
Thank you, Ms. Salazar, for your testimony. Member questions? Representative Sundin, you're muted.
I went on mute. yeah, it happens when you get older. Firstly, I'd like to thank the author for bringing this bill up. It's a terrific thing. But a question to the author, and I guess maybe to Mr. Dicklich might want to weigh in on this as well. Federal guidelines and some of our state guidelines require minority hiring on certain projects, and I think that's a great thing. It's kind of a tough thing to do in some areas, out in greater Minnesota, where the minority status or number of minorities might be different or non-existent sometimes. I'm just wondering what kind of outreach you can do with this program to supply minority workers for projects out in greater Minnesota. The problem is, you know, we've got contractors that want to abide by the law and the rules, and it's kind of tough sometimes. Puts our contractors in a spot, and I'd just like to see a little more activity out in greater Minnesota as well. But it's really good to hear some of the positive comments from your testifier. Thank you.
Representative Berg or Mr. Dicklich, who wants to tackle that one?
I'll let Tom tackle that one. Thank you.
Mr. Dicklich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sundin. With the expansion of this program, it started as Metro Base, and just last year it worked its way into Duluth. Expanding it statewide this year, we have a cohort down in Rochester now. As we continue to move forward each year, it'll get larger. We do reach out through community-based organizations, SOAR in Duluth, WDI in Rochester. We are making our way across the rural parts of Minnesota. Having those first 8 weeks mostly virtual is a huge bonus, and working with North Hennepin Community College to do that. They can work during the day because those are night classes for the most part. They can work during the day, and they can take these classes at night and push themselves into these careers. So as we expand and as we get bigger, this is year one of being statewide with the 41 members. Ideally, we'd like to be upwards of 80 cohort members from across the state of Minnesota.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you very much. I'm just trying to point out, you know, we've got a lot of talent out in greater Minnesota that could be roped into these terrific careers that some of us have enjoyed. Thank you.
Representative Bliss, you had your hand up. Did you take it back down? Or?
Yeah, I'm going to wait. I see a few other hands up. It's a small bill. Right. They probably have it covered.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I've got is to the author. Do you see this bill as it's written, that it's going to be statewide apprenticeship programs in the building and construction trades? Is it specific to unions, or is it the construction trades in general? Mr. Chair.
Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh. This is a program that's built through the construction trades. So at this point, it is offered through their programming. I don't know if Mr. Dicklich wants to add a little bit more, but it is their curriculum, and so therefore their program.
Representative Raleigh.
Same question to as Representative Berg just referred.
Mr. Chair and Representative, right now the cohort we in the past cohorts, we fund these through our affiliates. We have an assessment to our affiliates, and they send money to the state, and we give this to our Building Strong Communities program, which is a nonprofit, so it has its own full labor management board. Anyone can join. Anyone can sign up for Building Strong Communities. We pay for it. They get the 4 college credits through the process. Hopefully they choose to stay in there. We feel we train our folks better than anyone else in the world. It is focused towards that, to get them into these programs, get them into our apprenticeship programs, which can be 3 to 5 years, and get them into trade working and building a career for themselves.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, and the question, Mr. Chair, was, is this going to be specifically a program that is for unions? Could any of the other organizations, like ABC, had testified that they've got over 70%, I don't want to get the number wrong, it was 76, but over 70% are non-union laborers, and I'm wondering if this program would be beneficial to them as well, or do you have to join a union in order to participate in this program, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Dicklich.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. Right now, these are funded by union affiliates. We have 15 union affiliates that fund this program. So the goal is to get them into our union trades.
Representative Raleigh.
So an observation, Mr. Chair, then is, if the testimony is that there are 15 separate building trades and that this is a specifically for the union, I'm wondering why it seems a bit specific that we're not taking into consideration the over 70% of those that are not in the trades. And I worry that we're spending money to advertise a program that doesn't really have any specifics on how the money is going to be used. And so I worry about that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be for the author. I have a question. You know, we also have the Helmets to Hard Hats program, and maybe Mr. Chair could also tap into this question. This is, you know, the money that's going to Helmets and Hard Hats, I guess it's pretty much funneled the same way towards unions. And I have a, you know, when we're talking as Representative Raleigh just pointed out, you know, 73% of the trade workers are non-union. I would hope that we use state funds that would be spread out for any worker that are in the trades and work it that way. That's just my opinion. And I know the Helmets, the Hard Hat area, they've done some good work over the years. And I'm not saying that this program is not good either, but I think when we're taking state grants, state money that's put out by all the taxpayers, that we should be looking at funneling that money through as many workers as possible. That's my opinion.
Is there a question there, Representative Detmer, or just a statement?
Pardon?
Is there a question there or just a statement?
That's a statement. And, I do have a question regarding Helmets to Hard Hats. Is that money strictly for unions also?
I would have to check on that, but I know we have people from the agency here that could answer that question. So somebody from DLI that's monitoring this, if they could weigh in. Maybe they aren't here today.
And Mr. Chair,
can we get the answer back to you, Representative Detmer, on that one?
And who oversees the Helmets to Hard Hats?
Department of Labor and Industry, I believe, Representative Detmer.
Okay, thank you.
We'll get the answer for that to you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative McDonald, I always like to let the lead go last, and we do have another member question before you. So it's from the DFL side, but it's up to you if you, you want to go last.
I think that's a good idea. Go ahead.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Dinklage. After somebody successfully completes the program, is it mandatory that they maintain union membership?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Frederick, the answer to that is no. We would like them to stay in there. We'd like to show them the benefits of the union, the careers that they can have, the lifestyle that they can live, giving them a good blue-collar living. But there's nothing to force them to stay in. Like I said, we invest heavily into training. We feel we do it better than anyone else in the world. So hopefully when they see that, they do stay within the confines of the union, but nothing stops them from leaving.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point that out because that's the same with the Helmets to Hard Hats program, which is a bill that I carried last year. It is not about forced unionization or some boogeyman like that. The Helmets to Hard Hats program is about getting military personnel who are returning to the U.S. into apprenticeship programs. It's about skills building just as much as this program and this bill before us is about skills building to people. And that is what it is about. It is not some sort of perceived boogeyman about being forced unionization or some sort of thing like that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dinklage.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, maybe this will help. This cohort that we have, we did get people from Helmets to Hard Hats, from Justin running that program. He did put people that were interested into this program. We only run this cohort once a year. It starts up in February and goes through May, so they're ready for the construction season. Helmets to Hard Hats is a year-round program, placing people into trades and jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Dinklage. I see Representative Detmer has another question. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe for Mr. Dinklage. Why do we only have, I think it's 27% of our tradespeople in a union? If it's, you know, I have nothing against union. I belong to a union for 34 years. But why only 20%? Yeah. Why so 27% are only in unions if it's such a good program? That's my question.
Mr. Dicklich.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know about those percentages. I have not found that number in Minnesota. I know we have 75,000 members that we represent. Depending what website you look at, some have 130,000, some have 160,000 construction workers in the state of Minnesota. So maybe I can work on getting that number. As for the rest of it, we feel we train our people very well, and we put them into these programs hoping that they'll stay in there and hoping that we can provide a service and build infrastructure.
Representative Dever.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and I've been down where they train the electricians, where they train the carpenters. I've been up north where they train the 49ers and the big heavy equipment and everything. And there's some great jobs for people. So I just feel, you know, if you could get back to the committee about that percentage wise, it'd be interesting to see maybe why only that percentage is in the unions. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, a question for the author. First and foremost, I think it's exciting. I think we're all on the same page that we're talking about the trades and a recruitment policy or recruitment or retention of some sort that we can expose the trades to many folks of all color, nominations, denominations, male, female. So it's very important. We all agree on that. I am concerned that with some of my colleagues that it's just for union trades, and I know they do great work, some of the unions in their construction industry and their safety. I've been down to their union halls and got a tour. So I know they do good work. But as Representative Detmer said, there is 73% of other trades, that including one that my son works for, that would certainly benefit greatly. Many mom and pop family businesses would benefit greatly. And maybe they'll benefit from those who have been trained and will go on and work for a family business instead of a union business. Not that family businesses aren't necessarily union, but there's so much more we could do with this if we open it up to the greater good and not just delineated to unions. But that said, question for the author and or maybe Mr. Dicklich, of this appropriation, how much of it will go towards going into the schools and educating the BIPOC community, or all people for that matter, no matter what color or race or creed you are, or male or female, in the middle schools where we can have an opportunity to train and enlighten folks to the great careers of the trades and the kind of money you can make? Is any of this funding will be able to do that?
Representative Berg, or Mr. Dicklich.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, this money is for this program. We reach out to seniors. There's eligibility requirements that you have to be 18 years old by, I believe, June of that year to be able to enter into that cohort. We don't have underage non-adults on work sites for safety reasons, obviously. There's other programs that reach out to the middle schools and the younger kids. Our goal is to reach out to kids. Not college isn't for everyone. We want to reach out to people and give them options. Working with North Hennepin Community College has given us access to the 12 school districts within their county to their student population. So our goal is to reach out to them. And as they do this, they do get those 4 credits. If they decide construction isn't for them, or they, I know it's only 4 credits, but they get a feel of the construction industry, they may want to go into construction management. It gives them that start. So I agree. I wish we could do more things to work with the middle schools and the younger students. This program is geared towards seniors in high school to get them through these 12 weeks and get them ready for a career in the construction industry.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Dicklich, do you ever see that the Building Stronger Communities will maybe lean that way towards the younger, you know, 16, 17-year-olds, even though they're not old enough to work on a site? Certainly 16-year-olds or 15-year-olds who parents are in a construction business or electrician or plumbing, certainly they have worked for their parents and are fully capable of doing so. I mean, for God's sake, you had some of our greatest generations who were 17, 16, who went to war and fought the Nazis and conquered, you know, totalitarianism. Who lied about their age, of course. Some of the greatest generation. So we're missing out. Do you ever see your organization maybe pushing back on that and getting that younger crowd? Because by 18, sometimes it's too late.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't know. I don't want to predict in the future. The challenges of the stresses on this, just to do this and run it statewide, there's a lot of moving parts to it. I think we need to perfect where we're at and get, you know, a full cohort and get these folks through this program and get them into the training, get them in these apprenticeship programs. And I would never say never. But that part hasn't crossed my mind. I know there's a lot of good organizations, community-based organizations, that do a lot of good work in the school districts to get these pathways into these programs, to get these students into interest in the trades, and hopefully this can be an ending spot for those students as well. So never say never. I don't want to give you a false answer and say, absolutely, we can do that next year. It's a lot of work to run this program. So if that's where we go in the future, that'd be great. Right now, we have our focus.
Representative Donald, I see one of your committee members has raised his hand again. Do you want to continue, or should I go back to him?
Well, why don't I do this? I'll end it, and then Representative Detmer can finish up. So, Jim, then lastly, last question for the author or Representative Mr. Dicklich. So the trade unions, again, I'm not dissing them. They do great work. I have several friends that are in the industry. My concern is that this bill is just crafted towards them, a lot of money. Trade unions do, you know, they take union dues out of each member. Some of them paid for, you know, they go towards their candidates they don't even agree with. Is there any funding from a union dues that goes to an organization such as yourself that does recruitment and education to expose people to the trades?
Mr. Dicklich.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. There's a fine line between the training centers and the actual locals and what they can and can't do and what they can and can't fund. I don't know exactly how they break up their paychecks and what part goes to training, what part goes to their benefits. I can maybe get a clarification on that question. We can work to get you better answers. I don't know how that breakup is, but they do have portions of their check taken out. And these locals, these unions, these affiliates, they invest heavily in training. You've been to some of these training centers. They're top of the line. We try to give these apprenticeships and these people coming through this program the best experience they can. We try to give our members the best training they can have. Like I said, we feel we do this better than anyone else in the world. And some of these questions, I'll go back to, you know, just focused on the union. And said, I think helmets to hard hats actually can put people into the ABC. I didn't know about the ABC until last week when Ms. Hennen testified against this bill. So here we are. If they wanted to reach out, they want to talk about future getting their people involved into union, these union apprenticeship programs, we'd be more than willing to listen to them to have that meeting. I didn't know about them to reach out to them, so that's on me, and maybe I should reach out in the future. But we do have a great program, but long answer to a short question. I don't know exactly how the money gets funneled or taken out from their checks and put into these different pots of where that supports these trades.
Representative McDonald.
I bet if you ask a lot of your members, the members in the unions, they just soon have their money not go towards a bunch of politicians and went towards better training and recruitment for new, younger people coming up in the ranks to learn the great careers of trades.
Are you Mr. finished, Chair. Representative McDonald? Or?
I'm all done. I'm cutting myself off.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just come up. I think you know I've been trying to get a bill through education where the trades have come to me, military recruiters have come to me. They would like to be able to have access to our schools. And there's several schools around the state that don't allow military recruiters and the trades to come in about job opportunities and careers in those areas. And I know the three schools that I represent, Stillwater, Forest Lake, and Chisago, they do a great job. When they have a college fair, they invite the trades in. They don't have to come, but they invite them, and the military recruiters, they come in, and they can answer questions for our students. And, you know, there's some great opportunities, some good paying jobs out there. And I would hope that maybe if anybody has some connections with, I'm not on the K-12 Education Finance Committee or the policy, it's a policy issue. There's no cost to the state that when a school has a college fair that they would have to also invite the recruiters, the military recruiters for all the branches and academies, and also all the trades. And we're doing a disservice to our students by not allowing them to see what's out there, because not every student needs to go to a four-year college. We have some great programs out there in the trade schools. So that's just a comment. So if you know people on the education committee, let's hear this bill. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I had to put my hand up as a former union, or actually I am still a union member, former employee of the Carpenters Union. When we put money into our education fund, which funds our apprenticeship programs, we vote as members. We vote to put that on off our check and into these funds. That's how the money gets there. These programs, the apprenticeship programs, are funded wholly out of our union dues and out of our union wages. That, like I said, we have put that money there. There's no federal money. There's no state money in these programs. It's all money by the membership. And again, we vote to put that on our checks ourselves, or on in those funds ourselves, and take that money off our paycheck and put there. That's how the money gets there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Frederick.
I kind of want to echo a little bit of what Representative Nelson said, that it is the individual unions, individual locals, that decide how much their union dues are going to be, and it is an individual choice to whether or not they want to be a union member and pay those dues. And so if somebody doesn't want to pay those dues, they don't have to be a union member. And so I want to refocus that this bill is about skills building to communities that have not traditionally had those opportunities. And I want to thank Rep. Berg for carrying this piece of legislation, because as we've heard in testimony today, it is something that is needed, and I hope we can get it past this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Before I pass it over to Representative Berg for final comments, you know I have to weigh in. So first off, Ms. Hennen, Mr. Dicklich has some homework that he needs to bring back. Anybody can cite numbers and percentages, so I would like to see the numbers and percentages that you are citing, so I have those for my future information. And the other comment is, the BSC is a good program. Anybody can approach any legislator to try to get some kind of program like this going. So I fully expect that maybe next year we'll see something from ABC. Final comments to your bill, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your comments and questions. I just honestly want to walk us back away from the mention of Nazis and the argument about whether or not people have to be in a union. This is a bill that creates a pathway to opportunity.
Oh, Representative Berg froze up on her clothes.
And left out of these types of need for more skilled labor than ever before. This bill is incredibly timely. It was made very clear to Ms. Hennen at ABC that this program, which is paid for by unions, therefore put out by the unions, that yes, once they go through this program, we hope that they stay as members of the union so that they can make family sustaining wages, have access to health care. We know that there are stronger safety standards on a union job site, and all the benefits that being a member of the union brings to you is what we hope to share with the people who come through this program. My youngest son has been on a non-union site putting in windows, and he just came to me and was like, Mom, I think I made a mistake, right? And we were having the discussion about how to transition him over into a program with the trade. But it's their choice. So I just want to, like, answer that as part of the discussion, that yes, they will go through this program and be members of the union, but they are not required to stay in the union. So I think that argument is a little bit false there. So I would ask for your support for this. It's a great opportunity for our veterans, which I know we all care about, for women, and for members of BIPOC communities. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 3953 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Finally, members, we have House File 3403 from Representative Stevenson. I move to refer House File 3403 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to our committee, Representative Stevenson. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a straightforward bill. It relates to licensure and making sure that people understand what they're getting into. So what it does is it creates a process where people will be able to find out before they start down the road of trying to obtain a license, whether they are disqualified from that license because of a prior criminal conviction. Now, I want to be very, very clear. There is nothing in this bill that changes the qualifications for any license that the state offers. If you are disqualified from having a profession because of a criminal conviction under current law, this bill does not change that. What it does is allows you, before you go and get a bunch of education or training or invest dollars in trying to get a licensure, you would be able to send in your records or get a background check from a department, and they would tell you either you are eligible or you are ineligible, allowing that person to make a good informed decision about whether they should continue down that path. I'm a prosecutor in my private or my non-government, non-legislative work, I guess. And I know that it's really important that we get people reintegrated into society once they have paid their debt. And we want to make sure that it happens smoothly and that they understand the options in front of them. That's very important to ensuring there isn't recidivism. So I think that this is a common sense bill that enables that. I want to note that at this point, it's been through three or four committees, and we've had bipartisan support in each committee it's been through. I'm hopeful we can earn that here today as well. And Mr. Chair, I believe there are some testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Today we have Anna Odegaard, Director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. Ms. Odegaard, please identify yourself for the record and welcome to the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Odegaard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. We call it MABC for short. We are a statewide coalition of 135 nonprofit organizations working to reduce barriers to economic mobility. We have been working in partnership with the Justice Action Network, the Institute for Justice, and the Council on State Government's Justice Center to advance this legislation that creates better transparency in the state licensure process. I hope you'll take a minute to look at their written testimony, which I believe is in your packets. We are very grateful to Representative Stevenson for taking the lead on this legislation, and of course, Chair Eklund for hearing the bill. The Minnesota Asset Building Coalition considers the Transparency and Licensing Bill a top priority because many of our member organizations offer workforce development services, including for individuals working on reintegrating into their communities after incarceration. Lack of transparency in the licensing process is a barrier to work for many of their clients. For instance, my colleague Ken Suryakov from Goodwill Easter Seals, which is an MABC member, explained to me that because there's no formal process for people to find out if their criminal history will affect their eligibility for a license, instead people rely on rumor. So someone hears from someone with a similar conviction that they were denied some other kind of license, and as a result, sometimes his clients are reluctant to even try to qualify down for some vocational paths that could lead to family-sustaining jobs, because they can't afford to make that investment without knowing whether there's a possibility of licensure at the end. This may seem like a problem affecting only a small number of people, but roughly 30% of American adults have a criminal history, and about 22% of jobs in Minnesota require some kind of license or registration that can be denied based on a criminal history. Multiple studies have shown that finding employment reduces recidivism for individuals who have been justice involved, and that higher quality jobs have a greater effect on recidivism. A straightforward process for people who have a criminal history to find out how their record impacts their eligibility for professional licensure benefits businesses that need qualified licensed workers, supports stability for those individuals and their families, and ultimately benefits our communities. Thank you so much for considering this bill in your committee and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. Any questions from members? Chair Stevenson. Oh, Representative Raleigh.
Sometimes it takes a moment to find the little buttons. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. To the author of the bill, I'd like to look on the first page, and it says on line 1.13, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, all state licensors shall permit a person to submit a preliminary application. Is there currently any laws to the contrary?
Chair Stevenson.
I think that the Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, I don't believe that there's I think the answer to that question would be that there's several agencies that offer licenses, so I can't comment authoritatively about each agency's laws, but what I would say is that preliminary applications like this aren't currently authorized in law and need authorization.
Okay.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as these preliminary applications are being evaluated, if we now turn to page 3.3, it says that decisions are going to be binding. And so if a preliminary application is submitted, the application or the decision on that application becomes binding unless one of three areas are met, which are they're convicted of a crime that disqualifies them, incomplete information was received, or they just flat out lied. What I'd like to ask, Mr. Chair, to the author is how does this new law, how will it be seen in relation to 245C.15, which prevents the dangerous backgrounds from being applied for? And this would be for like our vulnerable adults working with children and so forth. How would this new law work alongside of or in contention with 245C.15, Mr. Chair?
Chair Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that particular statute in front of me. I just want to, before answering your question, I want to be clear about that. But let me, I understand the question. I don't think I need to have the statute in front of me to answer it because they work collaboratively. If someone is barred from working with vulnerable adults or children or anyone else because of a criminal conviction, what would happen, and they apply for a job or they submit one of these preliminary licenses, they would find out that they are disqualified and that they would not be able to get the license. And then they would not get the license, presumably because they found out that they are not qualified for the license. They wouldn't go and get whatever education or training or other qualifications they need to do to get the license, saving them time, money, and resources, as well as the state or whatever entity provides the training and education. Yep. So it will be more efficient. But to be very clear, if a person is disqualified under the section that you mentioned or any other section in law because of a prior criminal conviction, this bill does not change that. There is nothing in this bill that changes that.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Stevenson. You're going exactly where I'm going. Because if we're looking at multiple laws and we're doing the best that we can you tell me what happens if best efforts were made, a determination was made underneath 3.3 that the decision is binding, and it turns out that the person who made the decision just flat out made a mistake. They looked at the wrong area, whatever reason. I don't want to give you too binding or too narrow of a definition. So let's just say the most permissive possible mistake was made. It was really nobody's fault, but the person went through the training. They're now at the end of it, and they are statutorily denied a license that they were told that they had a decision as binding. Where is the liability in this, and who would be responsible for that bad decision, Mr. Chair?
Chair Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, the same thing that would happen under current law if someone made an error in the process. All we're doing is moving the evaluation to before the person gets the training and the education rather than after. We're front-loading the process so as to avoid people going down a path that they shouldn't go down. You know, certainly mistakes do happen, but I think that we have a pretty good licensing process. And I trust that in all cases that our professional staff is going to make sure that people aren't pre-qualified unless they're absolutely sure that they're eligible to be pre-qualified.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I'm not a prosecutor, and part of my question was to the author, what does happen? And if you can indulge me for just a few minutes, I'm very curious as to how this law would be rolled back. And specifically, Mr. Chair, what I'm concerned about is the binding decision that was made. And the reason I'm worried about this is the tight time frame that is required from the time of application until a determination is made. And what I worry about is making sure that the written decision that has to be provided within 60 days, according to this bill, I worry that that might not be enough time, that we're taxing this organization unduly. And then I'm also trying to figure out how this is needed in light of the background checks that DHS is also doing as far as their vetting process. So it seems to me that there's a bunch of different moving parts, and that's why I'm asking, Mr. Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, it's worth noting that in most licensure applications, you're going to, one, there's going to be a time frame involved anyway on a background check. I know, for example, I'm working with a constituent who, in a childcare space where it's a two-week window, which is obviously much shorter than 60 days. And I suspect that's the reason why the agencies that are working on this have not had trouble with a 60-day time frame here. I think that we can certainly trust that the idea here is to make sure that people who are ineligible know that they're ineligible, not to change any of the requirements. And, you know, I am a prosecutor, but that I don't typically make licensing decisions, so I can't speak too much about how and when I say typically, I mean I just don't. So I can't speak too much about that process. What I can tell you is that, you know, someone being able to find a stable career and reintegrate into society is a great way to reduce recidivism. And it's a great way to make sure that they don't end up back in the criminal justice system. And we want to make sure that people are able to do that while at the same time protecting people from people who are in many cases dangerous. And this bill just makes sure that people don't get down a road that they don't belong on. If you are a, you know, violent criminal or someone who has a history of committing sex crimes, there are certain jobs that you should not have. The legislature has made that policy determination. And we don't want people going down that path. It's a waste of their time and our resources and makes it more likely that they're going to offend in the future. So all we're trying to do is make sure they know on the front end. And I think that's why you're seeing such broad buy-in to this idea in other committees and among the agencies.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And last follow-up, thank you, Representative Stevenson. That was very, very helpful, and I appreciate that. The last area that I've got a question on is the area of discretion. And I want to make sure that as we're looking at codifying what's going to be happening with this bill, can you talk me through what level of discretion you're intending with this bill? And I'm asking in light of, you know, we as a legislator provide some guardrails, basically, in the bills that we craft. Can you talk to me about the guardrails that you've envisioned under this bill and how it would relate to the discretion that a reviewer of these preliminary licenses would have? Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was my final question.
Chair Stevenson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, I think that there's a lot of discussion right now about discretion in the context of decisions that are made by prosecutor and judges, and I know that that's a very topical area. But it's important to note that licensing decisions are very different, that people who make those decisions do so in a very different way, that there is no such thing as prosecutorial discretion or judicial discretion with regard to a licensing decision. But even more than that, it's important to note that this bill does not change in one iota the discretion that someone who's making a licensing decision has. They would have the same obligation, the same restrictions, the same discretion, whatever it is under current law, before and after passing this, because all we're doing is having that decision made before they get make the investments in education and training instead of after. So if the point of this is that if you have facts on the front end, someone has a criminal conviction,
We'd rather they know that they can't be a nurse, that they can't be a teacher, that they can't work in a group home before they go and do all the other stuff. It's a waste of everybody's time and money. And if that's the case, we'd rather them be working towards other things that are more productive for society and for themselves.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, you bring up something, and I said it was going to be the last question, but you brought up something that I'm just curious about. How does this bill relate to convictions outside of Minnesota? And I apologize to the author. I've been looking for it, and I just can't find it, and I don't have a note on it. But what you brought up just sparked something in my head. Does this deal with out-of-state convictions? And will we be looking at other databases? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Yes, it does deal with out-of-state convictions. The way that data, criminal background data is assessed is on a national basis. There's something called an what's the acronym? Well, anyway, there's a national background check system that that we use in the criminal justice space and in the licensure space, I'm sure.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time.
Representative Bliss, you had your hand up and you dropped it back down. Are you okay?
Yep, Raleigh covered it. Thank you.
All right. Any other member questions? Seeing none. Final comments, Chair Stevenson. Oh, what? Representative McDonald's got his question up. Hold up there, Chair Stevenson.
Representative McDonald. Mr. Chair. Yeah, sorry. Just quick question. Representative Raleigh did cover many of mine, so that saved the committee some time. But a question for Representative Stevenson regarding expungement. I didn't find it in the bill, but I read it very quickly, but I didn't see any of that pertaining to expungement of any records. So could you touch on that?
First, Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. This bill does not include anything about expungement. So the rules regarding expungement are not changed with regard to any licensure.
Representative McDonald.
All right, and thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Stevenson, do you have any concern on that or not? I know it's a wide and a vague question, but regarding expungement, and it's a big topic, but do you have any concern at all regarding this in your bill?
Chair Stevenson.
Boy, that is a wide question, Representative McDonald. I think that certainly there are expungement proposals out there that I have seen in my life that I find concerning. I think that expungement oftentimes is actually important and right. For example, if someone is charged with a crime and then is later found to be not guilty either by an acquittal or the charge is dismissed for lack of evidence, expungement is an important tool to clear someone's record for a crime they didn't commit. Of course, it can be concerning in other ways and applied other ways. But the important thing is that this bill doesn't change Minnesota policy with regard to expungement. Doesn't make it easier or harder to get an expungement, doesn't change the way that your licensing decision is made with regard to whether you had an expungement. That law is untouched.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Stevenson. And I agree, I think people are given a second chance. The good Lord teaches us that, but you certainly can understand several concerns that I'm sure many have regarding your bill. You certainly articulated that, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Any other member questions? Final comments, Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and just to Representative McDonald, I agree with you. This is a very serious issue, and the issues you raise are important ones. And I'm trying to be very clear, but please don't make that understand that I don't think that the issues that the members are raising today are not important. I'm just trying to be very direct and clear because I think they are important. This is an important bill. It's a common sense bill. As I mentioned, it's had bipartisan support in every committee it's been through, and I hope it earns it here. I'd ask for members' vote.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I renew my motion that House File 4303 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
No.
Representative Detmer, no. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, no.
Representative McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Yes.
Representative Edelson, yes. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Sundin votes aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Greenman.
And Mr. She's having trouble getting on right now.
Greenman, do you vote aye? Do you vote aye? Greenman votes aye.
Representative Greenman, are you there?
I can hear him, Chair.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Mr. Chair, we have 8 ayes and 5 nays.
8 ayes and 5 nays. The bill is on its way to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and I think that's another reason right there where we need to be in person doing these things, but just the chair's opinion. Any other comments or questions from members? Representative McDonald, do you have your hand up, or was that just left up?
I just took it down.
Okay. All right. Members, tomorrow we got 6 bills on the agenda. We got done a little bit early today because we had 1 bill removed. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to move as quickly as possible through the agenda tomorrow. Most of them should be non-controversial. Any questions or comments? We are adjourned.